And now for reading and writing and radio.
In a few seconds, before their eyes, the wave had grown and come nearer and nearer, higher and higher. The air was filled with its roar and shout. It rushed over the flat, still waters of the ocean, and before Jaya could scream again, it reached the village and covered it fathoms deep in swirling, wild water, green-laced with fierce white foam. The wave ran up the mountainside until the knoll where the castle stood was an island. All who were still climbing the path were swept away, black tossing scraps in the wicked waters. The wave ran up the mountain until Kino and Jaya saw the wavelets curl at the terrace walls upon which they stood. Then, with a great sucking sigh, the wave swept back again, ebbing into the ocean, dragging everything with it, trees and stones and houses. They stood, the man and the two boys, utterly silent, clinging together, facing the wave as it went away. It swept back over the village and returned slowly again to the ocean, subsiding, sinking into a great stillness. Upon the beach where the village stood, not a house remained. No wreckage of wood or fallen stone wall, no little street of shops, no docks, not a single boat. The beach was as clean of houses as if no human beings had ever lived there. All that had been was now no more.
WSSR Radio at Sangamon State University presents Reading and Writing and Radio, a program about creative writing. Your host is Jacqueline Jackson, children's author and professor of literature at Sangamon State University.
When the movie Jaws was at its peak of popularity, a friend of mine said that he had the perfect idea for another movie. He'd write about the biggest catfish in the Mississippi, which would viciously attack all the boats and all the swimmers and the fishermen, and he'd call it Whiskers. And he said he would clean up, he'd make a mint. Well, they didn't rest long after Jaws to bring out more thrillers of that sort. Grizzly came out, and my kids were quite scornful about the newspaper ads. They called it a gut-crunching, man-eating, and the point is that you can't crunch guts. You can crunch bones, but not guts. But I pointed out that still the effect of horror is there, and that is what is wanted. In movies, we've been going through quite a disaster craze. I take a certain pride in the towering Inferno because a classmate of mine from college is the author of that book from which they made the movie. But with the sharks and bears and fires and every natural disaster, we've got everything in the movies, including earthquakes, where they shake the theater so that you will feel more as if you are in the middle of an earthquake. Well, children's books have long been cashing in on disasters, and many of these books are very well written and exciting. There's nothing wrong with a good disaster. Sometimes a disaster is part of a larger story. You're all familiar with the Laura Ingalls Wilder series. The Banks of Plum Creek is the one I want to read out of, and a section where they are experiencing a plague. Day by day, more and more grasshoppers hatched out of the ground. Green grasshoppers of all sizes were swarming everywhere and eating. The wind could not blow loud enough to hide the sound of their jaws nipping, gnawing, chewing. They ate all the green garden rows. They ate the green potato tops. They ate the grass and the willow leaves and the green plum thickets and the small green plums. They ate the whole prairie bare and brown, and they grew. They grew large and brown and ugly. Their big eyes bulged and their horny legs took them hopping everywhere. Thick and all over the ground they were hopping, and Laura and Mary stayed in the house. There was no rain, and the days went by hotter and hotter, uglier and uglier, and filled with the sound of grasshoppers until it seemed more than could be borne. "Oh, Charles," Ma said one morning, "seems to me I just can't bear one more day of this." Ma was sick. Her face was white and thin, and she sat down tired as she spoke. Pa did not answer. For days he had been going out and coming in with a still, tight face. He did not sing or whistle any more. It was worst of all when he did not answer Ma. He walked to the door and stood looking out. Even Carrie was still. They could feel the heat of the day beginning and hear the grasshoppers. But the grasshoppers were making a new sound. Laura ran to look at them, excited, and Pa was excited too. "Carolyn," he said, "here's a strange thing. Come look." All over the dooryard, the grasshoppers were walking shoulder to shoulder and end to end, so crowded that the ground seemed to be moving. Not a single one hopped. No one turned its head. As fast as they could go, they were all walking west. Ma stood beside Pa, looking. Mary asked, "Oh, Pa, what does it mean?" And Pa said, "I don't know." He shaded his eyes and looked far to west and east. "It's the same as far as the eye can see. The whole ground is crawling, crawling west." Ma whispered, "Oh, if they would all go away." They all stood looking at that strange sight. Only Carrie climbed onto her high chair and beat the table with her spoon. "In a minute, Carrie," Ma said. She kept on watching the grasshoppers walking by. There was no space between them and no end to them. "I want my breakfast," Carrie shouted. No one else moved. Finally, Carrie shouted, almost crying, "Ma, Ma!" "There, you shall have your breakfast," Ma said, turning around. Then she cried out, "My goodness!" Grasshoppers were walking over Carrie. They came pouring in the eastern window, side by side and end to end, across the windowsill and down the wall and over the floor. They went up the legs of the table and the benches and Carrie's high stool, under the table and the benches and over the table and the benches and Carrie. They were walking west. "Shut the window," said Ma. Laura ran on the grasshoppers to shut it. Pa went outdoors and around the house. He came in and said, "Better shut the upstairs windows. Grasshoppers are as thick walking up the east side of the house as they are on the ground, and they are not going around the attic window. They are going right in." All up the wall and across the roof went the sound of their raspy claws crawling. The house seemed full of them. Ma and Laura swept them and threw them out the western window. None came in from the west, though the whole western side of the house was covered with grasshoppers that had walked over the roof and were walking down to the ground and going west with the others. That whole day long, the grasshoppers walked west. All the next day, they went on walking west. And all the third day, they walked without stopping. No grasshopper turned out of its way for anything. They walked steadily over the house. They walked over the stable. They walked over Spot until Pa shut her in the stable. They walked into Plum Creek and drowned, and those behind kept on walking in and drowning until dead grasshoppers choked the creek and filled the water, and live grasshoppers walked across on them. There is a story of a disaster, a grasshopper plague. In my book, The Taste of Spruce Gum, there are various disasters that happen up at the camp on top of the mountain. "Libby! Libby!" Mama was screaming her name. Libby sat bolt upright. The room was filled with smoke, and a strange glow shone from below. She leaped choking to the floor and ran for the stairs. Mama seized her halfway down. "Oh, Libby, thank God!" They stumbled to a living room dense with smoke. Libby glimpsed the kitchen, a mass of flames. As they reached the door, it flew open, and Uncle Charles pulled them out. A blast of cold shocked her. Snow scalded her feet. She gasped, blinked her streaming eyes, and for an instant had a clear picture of black sky with stars hanging still, each one as if suspended by a thread. She felt herself scooped up by someone smelling of sweat and sawdust and whiskey, who ran with her in great jarring strides down the hill. She clung on his shoulder, coughing and crying. Behind them, the kitchen end of the new house flamed, and windows in the other rooms winked red. I could give you a long list of disaster books where the whole story is built around the disaster. I'll give only a few. We began with Pearl Buck's The Big Wave, where a tidal wave destroys a Japanese village. Theodore Taylor's The K takes place in the Second World War. The boat is torpedoed. The boy on the raft becomes blind. He and his companion are abandoned on a desert island when the raft gets there, and the ending, near the ending, is a terrific hurricane, which he survives, but his friend does not. Richard Church's Five Boys in a Cave tells of five boys who are lost in a cave, and which one holds his head, who knows what to do, and which one loses his head, doesn't know what to do. Ivan Southall has a series of books that deal with disasters. Ash Road is about a brush fire that comes across the prairie, I guess you'd call it, or the bush in Australia. Hill's End tells of a storm that cuts off a bunch of children from civilization, and they are on a sort of island once this storm is over, and they have to get along by themselves for quite a while. Paul Berna has a book called Flood Warning, and here the kids are stranded on top of a tower of their school. And Veronique Day has a book called Landslide, and here a group of kids are buried by a landslide in a house. They are safe in the house, but the house itself is buried, and there's a little bit of air that can get into it, and in the dark they have to figure out what to do. I have a series of books I haven't read yet by Andrew Salke, but I was attracted to them because the titles were simply Drought, Hurricane, Earthquake. So I figure that those books are going to be about disasters. And when we get to war disasters, why, there are many, many books, and I would recommend as the best of them all is Meinert de Young's The House of 60 Fathers. Well, what's the reason behind our preoccupation with disaster? Let's talk about children's fascination, though also much of what I say would apply to adults. I have a few ideas. The first is this fascination with a vicarious experience of something horrible. If it's well written, then you're there. You're experiencing the grasshoppers walking, or the fire, or the drought, or whatever it is. I can remember a couple years back Elspeth saying to me, "Nothing ever happens around here." And I would say, "Oh, yes, it does," you know, and I'd start listing all the things that were happening. And she says, "Oh, but the house doesn't burn down, and there aren't any floods, and there aren't any tornadoes." And I said, "You know, thank goodness there isn't." And then Elspeth would say, "But nothing ever happens." Well, if it really did happen, I think that she would not be so happy about it. But by reading about them or seeing movies about them, we can experience the terrible event, see what it's like, without actually having to go through it. It's a kind of safe fear. I'd say there's another sort of fear, slightly different. It's the fear that this could have been me. It could have been my house that was swept away when the dam breaks. It could have been my house that was covered by a landslide, or that I could have been there when the avalanche came. But I think that particularly in children's books, the fascination is in the coping, because in the main world, usually it's the adults that cope in real emergencies. When the fire comes, when the flood comes, the kids are told what to do. But in most children's books, when you come to a disaster, it's the kids that do the coping. They make the decisions, whether they're going to be heroes or cowards, as in The Cave. And as you read those books, I think that you and I both are sizing ourselves up. What would we do if we were in that situation? How would we react? Would we be the hero? Would we be the coward? Would we be somebody in between? Or could we cope? Would we get the good ideas or lead the others to safety? Up until now, I've been talking about huge disasters. Most of us haven't been in huge disasters, or in disasters averted, although recently there was a gas truck north of our town in another little town where they had to evacuate in the middle of the night everybody living in that little town. Nobody was hurt. They managed to get the truck under control and the poison gas stopped. But if you had been living there, you would have quite a story to write. For today, if you've been in a large disaster, why don't you write about it? But what I'm suggesting is that we talk about small disasters. Small disasters are not necessarily small. They're small to others, but they're big to us. They don't need to be earth-shaking or theater-shaking ones. Craig Sather of New Richmond once wrote in, "Disaster is overflowing your friend's toilet." And Tom Mack at Little Flower School in Springfield said, "Let's have a program called Disaster Area, about when some disaster spoils your plans." Now, I don't think he meant invasion from Mars or bubonic plague or something like that. It could be your sister or your brother or you coming out all over spots when you're just 10 miles out of town on your summer vacation trip. It could be something of the sort that, here's a humorous one. I don't have the story, but I remember that Ian Gregg of Dvernon wrote in 2 years ago a story that he called Disaster, and it was a one where he was a little bit of a boy and he was in the yard with no clothes on and so was the dog, and somehow they both got out of the yard and went streaking down the street, and he said that his mother came rushing after both of them but that she rescued the dog first. Or we could have a poignant story of a disaster. My daughter Demi, when she was in second grade, was allowed to bring home the class guinea pig for the weekend. And when she carried Pepper back to school, she didn't carry Pepper in the box. She carried Pepper under her coat, up close to her body. It was chilly out, and she also wanted to feel that little furry animal up against her. When she got to school and was about to put Pepper back in his guinea pig box, he recognized where he was, and he made a leap for the box and missed and fell onto the floor. And the teacher, who was standing nearby, said something very sharp and sarcastic to Demi about not carrying the guinea pig properly in his box. Well, Pepper wasn't hurt. He got picked up and put back into the box, into his cage, that is. And Demi didn't say anything more to the teacher, but she suffered over that. She suffered for months over the disaster of having dropped little Pepper even when she didn't mean to. And she finally wrote on a Valentine in very small letters to her teacher, "I'm sorry, I dropped Pepper." And it wasn't until that point that her teacher realized how Demi had been agonizing over that little incident, little to the teacher, but huge to Demi. So if we're going to write about disasters, what'll we write? We could make up a story. Humans in a crisis. It could be animals in a crisis. Watership Down, for instance, is a series of disasters that happen to rabbits, starting with a human gassing of the rabbit warren and going on to rabbit snares and all sorts of other things until finally the rabbits are safe in their new rabbit warren on top of Watership Down. You could write about a real experience. Have you encountered any big or semi-big disasters, flood, earthquake, tornado, lightning? How did you cope? In a sense, these are easier to write about than the final sort of idea, which is the one, as I said, that's the most interesting to me. And these would be your small but plenty big to you private disasters, like Demi and Pepper, that maybe nobody else was ever aware of. How did you cope in your little disasters? How did you solve the disastrous problem? Or is it still there, causing you to squirm at night, to be unhappy, trying to figure it out? What is your disaster area? We'll be right back.
WSSR Radio has presented Reading and Writing and Radio. Send your writings to Jacqueline Jackson, Sangamon State University, Springfield, Illinois, 62708.